Good morning, diners and travelers. You're listening to On the Menu with Ann and Peter Haig. And today we have news and views for you.
News and booze, you said?
Yes.
Wasn't it Ogden Nash who said candy is dandy but liquor is quicker?
Yes.
Well, here's a program that sort of proves that. Some very interesting points of view on things we commonly drink without thinking very much about them.
But we want to first do the up-and-coming event that everybody should know about in Nashville, Tennessee.
Incidentally, there's going to be a lot of booze at this event, too, as you'll find out.
Oh, really?
When we talk to Tim Love, who, although he's not from Nashville, he actually has a big farm in Tennessee. That's
part of
the connection.
I see. Yes, and he's a chef.
Yeah, and he came to us all the way from Fort Worth, Texas, to talk to us, even though the event we're talking about is in the Music City, USA, Nashville, Tennessee. The Music City Food and Wine Festival. Here's Tim. Welcome to On the Menu Radio, Chef Tim Love, talking to us today, I think, from Austin, Texas?
Fort Worth, Texas.
Fort Worth, Texas, just to keep me confused. But we're not talking Texas today, although it's always tempting to talk Texas. We're actually talking something else that starts with a T, namely Tennessee and the Music City of Nashville, where there's a big event going on, upcoming, that we knew listeners you'd like to know about, and Tim's the appointed spokesperson to tell us all about Music City Food and Wine in its second year in Nashville, Tennessee, coming up on the 20th of September. Tim, what's going to happen aside from a lot of music in Nashville during this festival time?
Well, as we all know, Nashville is a great music city, but starting last year, we wanted to bring a very special event along with my partners, the Kings of Leon and Vector Management, to bring a food and wine experience unlike anything Nashville's ever seen. So we came up with Music City Food and Wine Festival. It's a two-day festival, September 20th and 21st, starting with events at 11 a.m. on Saturday. We have a giant grand tasting of all that Nashville has to offer. We've got 22 different chefs offering samples of their food, as well as 40 different wine and spirits, all pouring samples of their great taste, and about 12 different craft breweries. It is a real plethora of tasting that will happen starting at 11 o'clock on Saturday. And just when you think you hadn't had enough, Saturday night we do a thing called the Harvest Night. And Harvest Night is probably one of my favorite events at the whole festival. It happens on Saturday night, and we have a stage where we have a great band play, but we also have all kinds of guest appearances from just unbelievable musicians come in and sit in while we have 20 different celebrity chefs from around the country, myself included, offering up unbelievable vittles and some great cocktails and some wonderful music. I mean, kind of the things that everybody likes in Nashville, much less around the country, right?
Now the afternoon, the 11 o'clock until 4 o'clock session is Nashville chefs, and the evening event is nationally known chefs?
That's correct.
Okay, and then the tasting of the local chefs continues on the following
on
day, right?
Yeah, you come back on Sunday, and we have another set of local chefs and regional chefs, I should say. They're all from Tennessee, Kentucky area, and again, the spirits and all the wines. And to be frank, an experience like this is really, you can't put a price tag on it, because if you imagine trying to taste 40 different wines, from all around the world, and about 18 to 20 different spirits and 20 different types of food from different chefs, you really can't even pay for that. So that's what makes this event so special, is that we have all this talent and all these great flavors and all these great opportunities all in one spot, and it happens over 2 days. And that's why we give you 2 days, because you clearly can't take the grand taste in one day.
Right. Now, are the chefs on Sunday different than the chefs on Saturday?
Yes, sir.
Okay.
So all local and regional talent on Saturday and Sunday, and they change out between the 2 days, and then all the spirits and the wine are the same, because let's face it, I love to have a good time, and I can drink some cocktails, but we can't get around to 40 different tastes of cocktails in one day.
No, I understand completely. Now, the whole event, you can find out information. What's the website?
The website is Music City Food and Wine Festival, all one word.
That's a long word.
Food and Wine Festival.
.com, right?
Yes, sir, .com.
And it's absolutely amazing. I tell you that the 2 days, including the evening session on Saturday, it's a bargain at $500.
$500, and that gets you every event that we do. Now, I got to tell you this. We've already sold out all of our travel packages, so we do need to act fairly quickly because things are selling quickly.
Right, but if you can find a place to stay, like we managed to do, even though a lot of the hotels are filling up, we did manage to find a place to stay ourselves, and of course, we're going to be there with bells on.
I hope so.
there's something else going on as well. There are some educational sessions, shall we call them?
That's right. So not only do you have all the taste rounds, but we have two what we call panels and also two cooking demos. I'll be doing two cooking demonstrations, one on Saturday and one on Sunday. Mine is called The Art of Burning Food, and teaching people how to sear things correctly and what makes that good char and why it's good. But also, there's a plethora of other ones. Trisha Yearwood's doing calls Your Piece of the Pie. Jonathan Waxman, who just put in a new restaurant called Adele's in Nashville, which is amazing. He's doing a little demo called Mother Knows Best. And one of my favorite guys, Mike Latta, his food's phenomenal.
Oh, fabulous. We love him from Charleston. I also notice you have Alan Shire from New Orleans there, too.
That's right. And Morimoto's going to be there, which is amazing. You know, I mean, to watch that guy cut fish is, like, unbelievable. And then, quite frankly, one of my favorite guys in the world, Andrew Zimmern, is going to be there doing some globally hot chicken from Bazaar Foods. Just going to be an amazing time. And it's kind of hard to explain how good it is once you see it, but you'll never not come back.
Great. Well, we look forward to being there. We look forward to meeting you, Chef Tim LaValle, there, and some old friends and some new friends in Nashville, Tennessee. Again, the dates, September 20 and 21. You'll want to arrive the night before because the sessions during the day on Saturday and Sunday start early.
That's right.
People must have an appetite and a thirst early in Nashville.
That's right, and it's a ton of fun, I got to tell you.
Great. Well, thank you so much for taking the time to talk to us today. And again, we look forward to meeting you real soon. And listeners, make your way there. You won't regret it.
That's right. Thank you very much.
Okay, bye-bye. Welcome to On the Menu Radio, Chef Tim Love, talking to us today, I think, from Austin, Texas?
Fort Worth, Texas.
Fort Worth, Texas, just to keep me confused. But we're not talking Texas today, although it's always tempting to talk Texas. We're actually talking something else that starts with a T, namely Tennessee and the music city of Nashville, where there's a big event going on upcoming that we knew listeners you'd like to know about, and Tim's the appointed spokesperson to tell us all about Music City Food and Wine in its second year in Nashville, Tennessee, coming up on the 20th of September. Tim, what's going to happen aside from a lot of music in Nashville during this festival time?
Well, as we all know, Nashville is a great music city, but starting last year, we wanted to bring a very special event along with my partners, the Kings of Leon and Vector Management, to bring a food and wine experience unlike anything Nashville's ever seen. So we came up with Music City Food and Wine Festival. It's a two-day festival, September 20th and 21st. Starting with events at 11 a.m. on Saturday, we have a giant grand tasting of all that Nashville has to offer. We've got 22 different chefs offering samples of their food, as well as 40 different wine and spirits, all pouring samples of their great taste, and about 12 different craft breweries. It is a real plethora of tasting that will happen starting at 11 o'clock on Saturday. And just when you think you hadn't had enough, Saturday night we do a thing called the Harvest Night. And Harvest Night is probably one of my favorite events at the whole festival. It happens on Saturday night, and we have a stage. We have a great band play, but we also have all kinds of guest appearances, some just unbelievable musicians come in and sit in while we have 20 different celebrity chefs from around the country, myself included, offering up unbelievable vittles and some great cocktails and some wonderful music. I mean, kind of the things that everybody likes in Nashville, much less around the country, right?
Now the afternoon, the 11 o'clock until 4 o'clock session is Nashville chefs, and the evening event is nationally known chefs?
That's correct.
Okay, and then the tasting of the local chefs continues on the following
on Sunday,
day, right?
Yeah, you come back on Sunday, and we have another set of local chefs and regional chefs, I should say. They're all from Tennessee, Kentucky area. And again, the spirits and all the wines. And to be frank, an experience like this is really, you can't put a price tag on it, because if you imagine trying to taste 40 different wines, from all around the world, and about 18 to 20 different spirits and 20 different types of food from different chefs, you really can't even pay for that. So that's what makes this event so special, is that we have all this talent and all these great flavors and all these great opportunities all in one spot, and it happens over 2 days. And that's why we give you 2 days, because you clearly can't take the grand taste in one day.
Right. Now, are the chefs on Sunday different than the chefs on Saturday?
Yes, sir.
Okay.
So all local and regional talent on Saturday and Sunday, and they change out between the 2 days, and then all the spirits and the wine are the same, because let's face it, I'd love to have a good time, and I can drink some cocktails, but we can't get around to 40 different tastes of cocktails in one day.
No, I understand completely. Now, the whole event, you can find out information. What's the website?
The website is Music City Food and Wine Festival, all one word.
That's
Music
a long
City
word.
Food and Wine Festival.
.com, right?
Yes, sir, .com.
And it's absolutely amazing. I tell you, the 2 days, including the evening session on Saturday, it's a bargain at $500.
It's $500, and that gets you every event that we do. Now, I got to tell you this. We've already sold out all of our travel packages, so we do need to act fairly quickly because things are selling quickly.
Right, but if you can find a place to stay, like we managed to do, even though a lot of the hotels are filling up, we did manage to find a place to stay ourselves, and of course we're going to be there with bells on.
I hope so.
now there's something else going on as well. There are some educational sessions, shall we call them?
That's right. So not only do you have all the taste rounds, but we have two what we call panels, and also two cooking demos. I'll be doing two cooking demonstrations, one on Saturday and one on Sunday. Mine is called The Art of Burning Food, teaching people how to sear things correctly and what makes that good char and why it's good. But also, there's a plethora of other ones. Trisha Yearwood's doing, calls Your Piece of the Pie. Jonathan Waxman, who just put in a new restaurant called Adele's in Nashville, which is amazing. He's doing a little demo called Mother Knows Best. And one of my favorite guys, Mike Latta, his food's phenomenal.
Oh, fabulous. We love him from Charleston. I also notice you have Alan Shire from New Orleans there, too.
That's right, and Morimoto's going to be there, which is amazing. I mean, to watch that guy cut fish is, like, unbelievable. And then, quite frankly, one of my favorite guys in the world, Andrew Zimmern, is going to be there doing some globally hot chicken from Bazaar Foods. It's just going to be an amazing time, and it's kind of hard to explain how good it is once you see it, but you'll never not come back.
Great. Well, we look forward to being there. We look forward to meeting you, Chef Tim Love, while you're there, and some old friends and some new friends. In Nashville, Tennessee, again, the dates, September 20 and 21. You'll want to arrive the night before, because the sessions during the day on Saturday and Sunday start early.
That's right.
People must have an appetite and a thirst early in Nashville.
That's right, and it's a ton of fun, I got to tell you.
Great. Well, thank you so much for taking the time to talk to us today. And, again, we look forward to meeting you real soon. And, listeners, make your way there. You won't regret it.
That's right. Thank you very much.
Okay, bye-bye.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
And okay. Here we are again.
But, yeah, here we are.
You know, I really didn't realize how much I did not know about the wonderful wild world of booze. But the more we talk to people, the more I realize there is a great deal to learn about it. And
we learn something new every time.
Oh, yes. Who knew
the whiskey started off with an entirely different name that's totally unpronounceable?
Yeah.
But they've been making this particular whiskey, Laphroaig, since, they started paying tax on it in 1815. and on the subject of taxes, right after we do the segment on a new kind of Laphroaig, a history of Laphroaig as a whole, but then Laphroaig Select, a very special new product of what is actually a special new company called Sunbeam Suntory. But on the heels of that, we're going to go back to the early days of the production of spirituous liquor in these United States, when it wasn't taxed either.
White Dog.
and a fascinating study of the history of bootleg liquor, otherwise known as moonshine or White Dog, as Anne mentioned. So it seemed appropriate to have some Brown Dog to start off with, some fine quality Brown Dog and some history in back of that. So here's Simon Brooking, followed by...
It's on right on the sheet of paper.
Jamie Joyce.
Okay, there we are. We're very well organized, you can tell today. But first Simon and then Jamie. One of my favorite sayings from my mother, who had sayings for everything, was you can't teach an old dog new tricks. Well, we have a guest on our program today who's going to prove to you that at least as far as Scotch whiskey is concerned, that's absolutely the furthest thing from the truth. First of all, Simon, welcome to On the Menu Radio. We're so delighted you're joining us today.
Simon Brooken.
Thank you very much for having me here on the menu. I'm looking forward to chatting all about Scotch and Scotland and the fantastic whiskies that we make.
Now, Scotch whiskey goes back centuries, but let's ask the question first. I mean, when is the first recorded history of a drink like today's Scotch whiskey?
Well, the earliest record goes back to 1494, where we've got a document in Scotland with a friar, John Corr, purchasing 8 bowls of malt to make akavite. Scotch whiskey is an akavite. It is a water of life. In the Gaelic word, uishgareha means water of life, but through the years it was shortened from uishgareha just to uishge, then anglicized uishge morphed into whiskey. So when you're talking about, when you order a whiskey, you're actually ordering water, good Scottish water in the Gaelic language. Now, the Irish like to say that they invented the whiskey during the time of the alchemist in the 13th century. We like to say we perfected that whiskey-making process in Scotland.
Now, when is the first recorded history of a Scotch like Laphroaig?
Well, for us, Laphroaig was established 1815 by the Johnston brothers on the tiny island of Islay off the west coast of Scotland. They had been making the whiskey prior to 1815, but it wasn't until 1815 when there was a law, an English law, that was taxing whiskey production. So we like to say on the bottle, instead of established 1815, it should read the year the tax man caught us.
There you go. Now let's be really definitional and come from an island off the west coast of Scotland, spelled Isla.
The island of Islay is off the southwest coast of Scotland. It's the southwesternmost island of the Hebrides.
Sure, sure. I said west. I should have said southwest.
Yes, it is. It's a Gaelic word. Islay, it means the island of Ireland. They were very simple folk back then. They didn't beat around the bush. But it's a great way to remember the region because a lot of folks say to me, Simon, is Laphroaig, it's from the island of Islay, Islay, how do you pronounce it? And I always like to say, just remember, it means the island of Ireland, and then you've got the pronunciation of the region. Or Islay, have another Laphroaig.
But ISLA and ISLAY are the same thing?
They are, correct.
Oh, okay. Then I'm confused. So I learned something new today. So if it's Islay, it comes from the same place.
That's correct.
Now, I wanted you to tell us a little bit about the characteristics. This is, first of all, it's single malt Scotch, right, with a great deal of terroir. And how would you list its characteristics? What differentiates it from other premium brands of single malt Scotch?
Well, Laphroaig is from, as we were just saying, the region of Islay. And in comparison to your Highland whiskies and Lowland whiskies, I always like to talk about the climate dictates the style of the spirit. The Lowland whiskey, the low rolling agricultural hills of the Lowlands, you get grain, grassy notes from the whiskies from the Lowlands. The Highlands, you're getting more of a floral heather style, more of a honey sweetness to the Highland style. And the Island style tend to have more of a smoky, briny quality. I always like to compare the west coast of Scotland to the west coast of North America. If you think about the climate and the weather that comes across the Pacific and hits up around Oregon and Washington State and British Columbia, the same thing's happening on the west coast of Scotland where the storms come all the way across from Canada, and landfall for many of the storms are along the south coast of the island of Islay. So when it's raining 320 days a year horizontally on the island, think about the people living on this island. They need a big-bodied, robust-style spirit to take the chill out of their bone. And so that's why the whiskies from these regions tend to be smokier, more robust. And that comes into play in the production because we use the peat to dry the barley to make our whiskey.
Oh, okay.
And because it's a damper region, the same way you sit around a campfire on a damp night, that smoke clings to you, same thing's going to happen to the barley on the island of Islay.
So what, you're getting sort of a double peat impact, because you're getting some peat in the water that's used to dilute the whiskey, I guess you could say, and at the same time you're adding the smoke as well.
That's correct, Peter. Our water source filters through the peat bogs. So, you know, if you take a bath on Islay, the water is brown from the peaty water. And so we're using that water to soak our barley, to soak it, to get it to ferment. We're using the water in the mashings. But it's a very clean water, though, that's the thing. But the peat from the different regions that smoke will give you different flavors. The peat in the Highlands is more decomposed pine trees.
Uh-huh.
The peat on the island of Islay is more decomposed seaweed. So I would like to give you the analogy. It's kind of like the difference between sitting around a campfire in the forest versus sitting around a campfire on the beach.
Uh-huh.
Those are the different flavors.
Very, very good.
Okay, now moving forward from 1815, I guess, when the first concept of what the recipe for Laphroaig might be was at least caught up by the taxman, you have been making a fairly consistent, full of smoke, filled with interesting barreling in various different kinds of wood, created a number of brands over the years. And you had a portfolio of about how many? And you had cherry, you had a variety of different woods.
We have ranged since the early 1900s. Actually, it was our distillery manager, Ian Hunter, in the early 1900s, who was looking for more consistency in the flavor. And so he started traveling globally to source good quality barrels. And it brought him to the United States, it took him to France, it took him to Spain. He went to Sweden as well, not for the barrels, but to help sell the whiskey. But by sourcing good quality wood, he was able to get a more consistent flavor when it came to marrying those different barrels from the different years. And that actually comes into play not just with our Laphroaig 10-year, where we're using Maker's Mark bourbon barrels in the aging of our whiskey, but also our more recent bottlings, Porter Cask, which has been out for about 8 years now, and that was a marriage of 200-liter bourbon barrels of Laphroaig with 125-liter bourbon barrels of Laphroaig. Those are the old Porter Cask, which were the kind of barrels that were used to bring the whiskey from the stills to market back in the day. So by putting into the smaller barrel more influence of the wood on the whiskey, a bit more of an oaky sweetness, we then took that success and then added quarter cask into a Oloroso sherry cask, and that was the birth of triple wood.
Okay, got it. Now,
so that's now three different types of barrels.
But you're still consistent with every other whiskey maker, Scotch whiskey maker I've ever heard of, that you're using a barrel that was previously used for something else.
Yes, by law, we are unable to use a new oak because there are too many tannins in the wood in the initial barreling, the initial aging of the whiskey. And here in the United States, by law, you can only use an American bourbon barrel once.
Yeah, we've talked about that on the show. It's really
So it's a perfect partnership for us.
Yeah,
right. But now you did something radically different, and you said going beyond the preliminary aging, we're now going to do what?
Well, for us, 70% of the flavor comes from the aging of the barrel. So we are able to, that's where we can experiment and play around with the original base flavor, and then how can we create new bottlings and new flavors for Laphroaig. And that is, our newest whiskey is Laphroaig Select. And that came about because John Campbell was interested again in looking at the early style caskings of Laphroaig with Ian Hunter in the early 1900s, when he would take different barrels that had been aging, marrying those different flavor profiles together to create a whole new style. So John Campbell selected from some of those classic styles, the quarter cask, PX cask, the triple wood, and the 10-year, married those, and then with a final maturation in new American oak cask. So that gave us this whole new flavor with Laphroaig Select.
Now, has anybody seriously done that before?
Well, to be quite honest, many of the distilleries have been doing for periods of time, but with each distillery, it's a different flavor profile, and it will create different results. And we love the results that we've got here with the Laphroaig. It's a lighter, sweeter style Laphroaig with a real lively peppery quality to it, which comes from the final maturation in the new American oaks.
Now, have you had a lot of response from consumers? They love it or they hate it? Select.
The Laphroaig Select has been reaching out to new consumers that are, but sometimes the heavier peated style, like the Laphroaig Tenure, can be a little overwhelming for some, as we have discussed in the past. And
yeah.
And so as a result, this is a little bit more of an entry level Laphroaig for those who are not ready to dive into the deep and smoky end of the Laphroaig grain.
Well, you know, I fell in love with it. You know, Peter told you about how my first reaction was not kind, but I fell in love with it when I was actually in Scotland, and it was freezing cold and rainy, and there was a nice roaring fire in the fireplace, and a shot of Laphroaig.
Now, here's the really funny thing. We were reading the background information that you sent, and one of the parts of the process of making Select that you haven't mentioned is that the maturation of the whiskies that go into it actually happens in the warmest part of the aging room, the warehouse or the cellar or whatever you call it. And God damn it, those Scottish summers, they're so hot. it makes a big difference.
It does, and we've actually one of our number one warehouse, we actually did not have access to the fourth and fifth floors because our elevator was broken, and so we weren't able to get barrels up to it. Well, we fixed the elevator. We've been able to get barrels up. The elevator broke again, so we're still waiting. So we can't get it down for a while now until we fix the elevator, but that's all right. It needs to spend some time up there. But, aging the barrels on the different floors will give you different, slightly different style spirits, because on the lowest floor of the dunnage, an earthen warehouse, it's very cool and damp. And up on the sixth floor, it's much drier and warmer. So the barrels will react differently, and so we've had the selectors use that, but we've also just laid some down in the last few years that we need to give them a few more years to see how they will react, and they'll be a slightly different style, and that's the beauty of single malt scotch, is the variety, and sometimes the impermanence of it. You can't. It's slightly ephemeral. I think that it's the way the whiskey used to be enjoyed. You know,
mm-hmm.
And you talk about sitting by the fire. To me, Laphroaig is the mother earth of single malts. It's very the terroir and the peat, but it's also very primal. It's about sitting around that campfire, as you say, and there have been people on Islay since 4500 BC. A very old spiritual place. The people of Laphroaig and Islay are very proud of the island and of the whiskey that's made there, and it's a testament to the people who make it that it is tasted all over the world now.
Tell us about the Friends of Laphroaig.
Absolutely. Well, Anna, are you a friend of Laphroaig? I would hope if you're... I know you drink it, so you're at least a casual friend of Laphroaig, but we also have a program called the Friends of Laphroaig program, the official program, where when you purchase a bottle, in every tube there's a brochure. It's got history and tasting notes, but most importantly, there's a code on that brochure. You put the code in on the Laphroaig website, and then we'll send you a certificate making you the proud landowner of a square foot of land on the island of Islay. So you come to visit your plot, and we'll put you in a pair of welly boots and give you a flag from your country, shove you out into the field, and then you go find your plot and stake your claim to your clan and your country. It's a great program. Keeps you in touch with what's going on at the distillery. Plus, you get birthday greetings and holiday greetings. And if the economy tanks here, you know you've got a place to live in Scotland. Right?
you better stand up pretty straight then. Now, let's
well, you need a bottle of Laphroaig in your hand to anchor you from the wind, and that's just fine. And also, we are celebrating our 200-year anniversary next year, 2015. So we're inviting all Friends of Laphroaig to come out and visit their plot during the 200-year anniversary. And we also have a campaign called Opinions Welcome about, as you were saying before, Anne, that it's a very polarizing whiskey, and we'd love to get people's opinions on it. And if you go onto YouTube and Google Opinions Welcome, there's a great campaign, and we want everybody to send in their opinions of what they think their whiskey, Lafroy whiskey experience is like. It's great.
Well,
it's a great campaign.
Now you better send us a code in case the bottle we in case the one we get done the next one we get doesn't have one in the tube. And
definitely. And you only get 1 square foot because we do get some people who, you know, say eventually the island will be mine. But you can apply additional purchases or those additional coupons to your plot and get points towards purchasing items on the Lafroy website.
There you go. That's wonderful. Listen, you promise you're going to come back on another show fairly soon and tell us about a new branch of whiskey making, the historical Japanese brand called Suntory. Until then, spell out Lafroy so that people don't have an excuse for not getting on the website.
Absolutely. Lafroy is LAPHROAIG. That last part, OAIGO, an intensely great whiskey.
Fabulous, Simon. Thank you so much for sharing this information with us today. It's been a lot of fun, too.
Peter and Ann, all my best to you and all your listeners and On the Menu, and look forward to seeing you somewhere out on the road. Come to Scotland sometime.
We've been, but we'll come again.
I could play a game with you and say, guess which sex is Jamie Joyce? But I won't do that.
Okay.
Jamie, welcome to On the Menu. By now, listeners, you will have figured it out anyway.
That Jamie is a one, and also that her parents had a good sense of humor, which is why she's named Jamie Joyce.
There you go.
Or they were Irish writer fans.
or something like that. But I hate to be sexist. Anne will probably hit me when I say this. But it doesn't really, prohibition and whiskey, moonshine in particular, doesn't sound much like a girl thing. Please explain.
Well, moonshine is definitely something that most people don't associate with women, and whiskey is something that people don't associate as a woman's drink, and I think that's wrong. I don't know why, but I know that there are many women who are now distilling. There's some terrific women distillers out there. There are bartenders and restaurateurs making an effort to appeal to women drinkers and creating cocktails using moonshine specifically, making them for women, using champagne and sherry moonshine and putting that in the flute. So there's lots of ways to appeal to women. But you know what? I don't mind drinking it neat. It's pretty good that way, too. Yeah.
Now, when I'm looking at the front book jacket, as I guess you would call it, of this rather cute size book, and it shows things like White Mule and Cat Daddy and Rot Gut and Firewater, and Panther Piss, and Mule Kick. Not really very girly things, but at the same time, this wonderful history book, which is really one of the things that it is, isn't it really, Jamie?
Yeah, this was absolutely I'm a history lover, and I love digging into old newspaper archives and talking to people and getting stories and learning about history and heritage and tradition. And that's really what moonshine is, I discovered. It really is. It's about tradition, and this has been something that's been going on in this country for hundreds of years. Distilling is a tradition that was brought over by immigrants from Scotland and Ireland and made to last for generations in this country. So yeah, it's a history, and I think it's a really accessible and fun history. I really tried to write about people. I mean, that was my goal, is to write about the people behind moonshine and to tell those stories, because I think that just makes it so much more engaging.
And they're grand characters, aren't they?
Oh, there are some terrific characters in this book.
And some of those, we should not ignore the fact that some of the leaders in this field were women anyway.
Oh, yeah. I mean, when I was writing the book, again, moonshine is something that people often associate with men and thinking about it. It's a good old boy's drink, and it's good old boys making it, but I really made an effort to find the women out there, and there were so many of them, and one of the women who was in the moonshine business in a slightly different way, she wasn't a distiller, but she was one of the people who drove the moonshine. She delivered it to customers, and her name was Willie Carter Sharp. And this was in the 1930s in Virginia, and she testified as part of what was called at the time the Moonshine Conspiracy Trial, and people were just absolutely dazzled by her because she had diamonds in her teeth. which I just found so funny because now we talk about people with their teeth blinged out, and here was this woman in the 30s with diamonds in her teeth, and she had done time during Prohibition for Prohibition violations, and she served time at Alderson Federal Prison, which ironically was where Martha Stewart ended up many years later.
Oh, right.
that's irresistible story.
Very suitable. Now, interesting thing is, we don't watch a lot of television, and one of the shows we never got into, I think because we sort of lost it at the beginning, was this show called Boardwalk Empire, which is set against a backdrop of the period of great criminality and corruption associated with Prohibition. Do you think that Boardwalk Empire itself, such a popular show, has actually had an effect and got people more interested in it, what was once upon a time illicit and still sort of feels a little bit that way?
Well, you know, I think it certainly couldn't have hurt because Moonshine, it has this illicit appeal to it, even though you can buy perfectly legal moonshine, a clear corn whiskey, can buy it at liquor stores, but just the name itself has this appeal, this illegal, illicit, criminal element to it, you know, and people like that, and there's something that's fun about sipping it out of a mason jar. I mean, so many of the moonshine products out there, many are sold in mason jars. You have that real, gives you that flavor, that taste for history. So I think, sure, shows like Boardwalk Empire, they pique this interest in this whole underworld, which is now not an underworld anymore. But one of the things, I do mention Boardwalk Empire in the book because, funny thing, Boardwalk Empire is shot at the Brooklyn Navy Yard, which is near me, where I live. And also in the Brooklyn Navy Yard is a distillery called Kings County Distillery. They make moonshine.
Wow.
So it's just such a funny coincidence. You've got this show shooting about Prohibition, and then you have a distillery, a real live active distillery that was the first in New York City since Prohibition, located in a Navy Yard where in the 1800s, federal agents were taking confiscated whiskey and whiskey stills from the surrounding Irish immigrant neighborhood and bringing them to store in the Navy Yard. So you have this history that's just linked, and it's just incredible how everything comes together like that.
I really have been very puzzled. A number of things about American history puzzle me, and one of them was that you could get all the states to agree on anything at all, but especially that alcohol was not just bad for you, but should be banned altogether. And so, so Prohibition seems like such an incredibly backward thing.
I write in the book about an interesting report that came out, and it was called the Wickersham Report. And basically what this found was, it was a report designed to study, well, what should we get rid of Prohibition? Should we repeal Prohibition? And by and large, the attitude of the report was that, yes, we should get rid of Prohibition. But the conclusion drawn from all that was, Well, we're not going to get rid of it yet. We're not going to do that. So it just made no sense. And you had people at the time, you had these writers who were, there's a terrific poem that is included in the book, and it's from a writer, I believe it was from the New York World, and he wrote this poem, "Prohibition is an awful flop, but we like it." And it didn't stop what it was designed to stop, but we like it. So just this irony, and it doesn't make any sense.
So it created a whole new industry and a whole new mode of transportation.
You bet.
So anyway, following that, I guess, we got this reverse, thank goodness. So the civilization returned.
Yes.
But I still don't think that the people who opposed the removal of Prohibition, and even those who supported it, would necessarily have liked the idea that little distilleries would crop up all around a neighborhood. I mean, that's new, and I think I didn't even know it was legal, and it seems strangely as though it's not quite.
You mean today?
Yes,
or
today.
Today. Oh, yeah. Well, today, you know, there was probably around 2008 or so, the mid-2000s, that many states began to make small craft distilleries legal. And so you see more and more of that happening across the country, and it's not just a southern thing. And a lot of it had to do with the economic downturn at that time in the country. And so here was a way to create small businesses, to encourage small businesses. And oftentimes, in many states, distillers are encouraged or incentivized, rather, to use local products. So for Washington State is a good example. I'm not sure if it's mandated, or I think it is mandated, that you have to use 51% of Washington State grain in your product. So they're really trying to keep the business within the state and encourage this working together of the farmers and the distillers and this real grain-to-glass movement, as many people call it.
Grain. Well, that's good. Grain-to-glass.
That's really interesting. Yep. I didn't realize that was a driving force. I guess it was just an opportunity for those people who are interested in founding craft distilleries to see if you like get some support behind them.
Yeah.
Now it's really odd here in our home Commonwealth of Pennsylvania, because here we still have the state in control of the liquor distribution and retail business. But at the same time, we have craft distilleries growing up, and the two.
Yeah.
We're glad we have the second. We hate the fact that we have the first. that they can coexist seems to us to be truly remarkable.
And you know, it's interesting that you bring that up, because the craft distilling movement really has a lot to do with the rise in moonshine. Because what moonshine is really, well, the term, when people talk about moonshine, that name comes from the beverage brewed by the light of the moon. You do it at night so that you aren't detected by authorities. But people still use the name today for a legal product, even though it's not a technical term that the government uses. But many, many small distilleries, as one of their first products, they put out a moonshine, or they call it white whiskey, depending on sort of who they want to appeal to.
The name White Dog comes from.
Yep, White Dog.
We had a book, but I never did get around to reading it, called Chasing the White Dog.
Yep.
So how different is that from your
book? It's the same thing. It's just a different name. White Dog, White Whiskey, Moonshine. And a lot of these small distilleries that have opened up over the last 10 years or so, but less than that even, Moonshine, or a clear white whiskey, an unaged product, it's a really good product to get up. You can get it out the door quickly. You're not aging it as you would a whiskey or bourbon. You know, you have to spend time with that. But a white whiskey, a moonshine, you can distill that and you can get it on your shelves and start selling that quickly. So it's a way for a lot of small businesses to infuse cash into their business.
Well, it's all very fascinating.
Yeah, it's really very...
As I said, I mean, there are all these regulations that come
up.
Like when we interviewed the people that make Tennessee Whiskey Rabbit, and they said, that what was it, something about aged versus unaged?
Oh, barrels. You have to, in order to be able to call whiskey bourbon whiskey, it has to be in single-use, freshly toasted oak barrels.
Yep.
And the same is true for Tennessee whiskey, but there was a fight brewing between, the Jack Daniel's company, which is the dominant supplier of Tennessee whiskey, and George Dickel, which is a smaller competitor, but which is owned by a giant international wine and spirits company called Diageo, with Diageo trying to say that it was all right to make Tennessee whiskey in used barrels.
It's all
very fascinating, especially when the used barrels from making bourbon all go to Scotland, where they get used to make brown whiskey. I always wonder what did they do for barrels to make whiskey before bourbon was invented?
Yeah, really.
Jamie, so what you're down this path, and do you have another idea for another book?
Oh gosh, you know, I'm thinking about what I want to do next. I haven't quite decided yet. I've just been having so much fun with this one so far, but the process was so fun, and I'm eager to get started on the next.
Now, you're an editor at Time Inc.
Yes, I am.
And who is it now? What's his name? Rupert Murdoch wants to buy Time Warner, right?
Yes. Well, he sure did. He just put in a bid last week, or actually this week. So he put in a bid for Time Warner, but Time Warner and Time Inc. just separated. So you're all right.
He
moved in at the right time, I guess.
Yeah. Now, what do you edit? What kinds of books?
I work in Time Magazine for kids. And so,
oh, I didn't know there was
so my one. Book is definitely for the over 21 set. let's be clear about that.
Well, it's a fascinating history book, a part of American history that people don't know very much about, all the way from the Whiskey Rebellion to the 21st Amendment to the emergence of craft distilleries. Lots and lots of wonderful characters, and something to do while you're sipping on your moonshine.
Oh, yes. Best way to enjoy it.
As the evening wears on. So thank you so much for all the scholarship that you've put into the subject. It's a page-turner. It's like you can't put it down.
Oh, thank you for telling me that. I appreciate it.
Jamie Joyce, cheers. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me. It's been a pleasure.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Welcome back. Next segment is really of a lower alcohol content, I believe.
No less interest, however.
No. But it's we're going to be addressing.
Well, beer, and then an even more old-fashioned drink, which is gaining popularity
mead.
Again, called mead.
Yeah, it's really
but,
popular.
First up, we didn't realize, I think, how much we didn't know.
About beer.
About beer and cooking with beer until we had the chance to talk to two young people from Charlottesville, Virginia.
And they really know their beer.
They sure do. And they know how to put it with food.
Yeah, so, there's Brooke and Luther Fedora.
And then after them, goodness knows why, Mr. Pyatt, what's his first name? Steve Pyatt is in Minneapolis making mead. There must be something poetic about that, I'm guessing. But he is an engineer by training, so he sure figured out how to go about making mead. Very well engineered.
He's
and very
accomplished judge of mead, so that I guess he quite a bit of it.
So you're going to want to find out more about this rather old-fashioned beverage, which according to Steve is making something of a comeback. So that's how we're going to finish up today's program. So it's beer first and then mead.
Before coming on air, we've been chatting with Brooke and Luther Fedora about all manner of things, including the hat, Fedora, which Peter Nell says he wants one of. But at any rate, what we're really scheduled to discuss is their book called The Foodie's Beer Book. And it's subtitled The Art of Pairing and Cooking with Beer for Any Occasion, which is exactly how this book is organized. Congratulations on a fine book. Peter, who is absolutely astonishingly mad consumer of beer.
I don't know about that. I do enjoy one every once in a while. I'm drinking a lot of Yingling Black and Tan just now. But I probably should be more adventurous, because it's possible to be so much more adventurous. Is that what really got you going, or was it a passion for beer, or was it that you just thought it was time because there's just such a wide range now available?
I think probably a combination. I think the variety was part of what excited us. We really enjoy beer, and it's something that we do at the restaurant. It's a big part of our restaurant. And so it was just perfect to put them together, and with the variety that we had just at our fingertips, it made it easy and really fun.
You know, I had no idea. I mean, this is all new to me, the content of your book, because I had no idea. Anytime I wanted beer in a recipe, I got the darkest beer I could find, and I poured it into things like stews. I never thought of all the other applications. Do you want to tell us how you've organized this book, which tells us a little bit about your thinking process?
Yeah, well, it's organized by types of party and also by season. We really like to cook seasonally, so basically each season there are different types of parties you can have, and we love to throw parties, so we kind of put those two things together.
But you sort of have a party every night at the restaurant, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's always a party. Non-stop.
Yeah. We might as well say what the name of the restaurant is, right?
I think we did, didn't we?
Did we say that?
No, well, we'll do it again. We'll do it again. If we missed it, we'll include it now. If we did it before, it'll be here for a second time. Go ahead. It's a gastropub.
Yes, the Horse and Hound Gastropub.
Then we didn't say it before.
I didn't hear it.
we said the definition of a gastropub.
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
But this... photographs are startling in this book. Did you have a really special photographer?
Her name is Brooke Fedora.
Well done, Brooke. Well done.
Brooke, that's
Thank
amazing.
You.
I mean, are you really a photographer?
Something I've been doing my whole life with my father is a photographer. He mostly specializes in outdoor photography. So when this book, when we decided to do it, I looked at Luther and I said, I think I want to photograph this. I want to try it and do it myself. And so that's what we did, and it worked out pretty well, I think.
You know, you talk about the possibilities and surprising possibilities. I opened this book to, how's this for a recipe that nobody would ever suspect is a beer-based recipe until you read the description? Hazelnut carrot cake cupcakes with hazelnut brown ale cream cheese frosting. Now that is amazing.
They're really good too. We just made them for Restaurant Week that we had in Charlottesville, and they're a big hit.
They're ridiculous.
So, and you've also just mentioned that you're in Charlottesville, which is an important thing to have on the air. You say the first thing you have to do about if you're going to cook with beer is understand the characteristics and also the flavor profiles of beer. And so you begin, first of all, a brief history of beer and how beer is made. And you have even in details in this history that I didn't know at all. Just the idea that it was a great healthful alternative to the unsanitary water at the time is something to think about.
Yeah, well, we knew this. We talked to somebody about that just recently. They brought up the fact that beer was probably popular for that reason alone.
Right.
Because it was a whole lot healthier to drink than the water that was available.
Yeah, but did you do you understand why they started putting hops in?
Well, I mean, I know what happens as a result of putting hops in, so I'm sure they were looking for a tartar flavor.
It allowed beer to be exported, transported.
Plus it's also a preservative.
Yeah, well, that's why it was able. You didn't have to make it.
Well, the whole thing of IPAs, India Pale Ales, is that they were brewed in Britain, and they were driven. They were not physically flown. They were shipped the long way around the Cape of Good Hope, headed for India. So you put as many hops as you could in, so you'd have beer worth fit to drink when you got to the other end.
Exactly.
But you brew your own beer, because there's a recipe here called Luther's Beer Recipe.
Yes. I brewed a few different beers, but that was one of the ones we did. Well, we don't do it a lot. We've actually been working with another brewery here in town, Three Notch Brewery, and we made a horse and hound beer, which was a double brown Belgian ale. So we had it just for us, and it was pretty awesome.
Yeah, and what a lot of people don't realize is the immense range of flavors. I mean, when most people think about beer, they think of Budweiser, and in the hands of students at the University of Virginia, like many other universities, including the one I attended, by the way, one of the objectives each evening, and especially Friday and Saturday, is to see how much of this you can slam into yourself before you collapse. And you're not really thinking very seriously about what it tastes like. You're looking for the fact that it quenches your thirst, and it tastes okay. Where range now is so amazing, so incredible.
Well, it's becoming more and more broad. It's sort of the way I like to describe it as a downward spiral in a good way. It's the more you experience, the more you want to experience more. And then you open your eyes and you see all these other new different flavors that, you know, are pretty wild, pretty out there, and you just want to do more. Then you pair it with the food, and you have these really great innovative dishes with these great innovative beers, and it's a lot of fun.
Now you've done the work with these dishes and with these beers of figuring out which ones really go together. So you must have drunk and eaten quite a lot in the process of doing this.
Well, you know, it happens.
what a terrible question.
Well, no, it happens.
It was a statement. It wasn't a question.
Oh, dear.
We're actually having beer can chicken for dinner tonight, by the way.
Oh, delicious.
Yeah, well, Brooke, you were talking about your family, and you always had beer can chicken on Sunday night. I thought that's what we're having tonight.
Yeah, but we have a sophisticated device. We have a special device with a prong which goes up inside the.
I've seen those. Yeah,
you've seen that one. They work really well, by the way. I mean, if you find one anywhere, get several.
Yeah, they're really good. But I mean, I never would have thought of putting anything in with related to beer with oysters. You seem to consider cider as beer.
Yeah, I think it definitely fits in that category. I mean, if you're getting really picky, I suppose cider is its own thing, but it often does get lumped into the beer category opposed to, you know, wine and other spirits. But yeah, we really, really enjoy cider, and that's definitely been part of what things we enjoy cooking with, and it goes with a lot of food, and you can do some creative things with it. So we thought it definitely fit in with the book.
Yeah, I've been moving away from cooking stews with wine, which is using beer, the darker the better, frequently, because of the body that it brings along. Somehow or other, there's a rusticity, but there's a body that this liquid, even though it's still a liquid, conveys to the end recipe. So I'm guessing you found that, and of course you went on way beyond that.
Yeah, we found that beer is just so complex. There's so many flavors, and within each beer, they all have their own flavors and their own complexity, and it really goes so well with food, and it adds that extra richness to a dish.
Now here's a key question, and this is because what I'm thinking is not only will people cook these recipes, but they'll also want to make up their own. Especially if it turns out they don't have just the beer and just the ingredients to make one of the things that you're suggesting here, that you know how to make exactly, so all the measurements are correct and all that stuff. Should people start off with a beer they like and then say, I could use this in this dish? Or is it the other way around? I have this dish and I know the one ingredient it needs to make it better is beer, but then you have to decide what kind of beer.
And, you know, it works both ways. We did a lot of those recipes in there. We did both ways. Some of them, if we had a beer that we just loved, we would take that beer, we would look at it, we would taste it and figure out all the flavors that it had and then design a dish around it. And then sometimes we had a dish and we said, we love this dish, we want to include it, and what beer would go best with it. So really, you can do both. Both options work incredibly well.
Now, you're seasonal in terms of your recipes and your menus for, like, harvest dinner is the one I'm looking at right now. You're also then seasonal with your beers. I mean,
beers have always had
seasonal. They're always seasonal.
They've always had a season. I mean,
wheat
beer is supposed to be drunk in the summertime. I can't say I ever really care for it. Bock beer is supposed to be drunk in October.
Yeah, well, that's
so,
what they think.
There are a variety of approaches anyway, right?
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
I'm amazed at the inventiveness of most of your recipes, but you also throw in some standard ones. I think Peter will take issue with your full English breakfast because you don't have any black pudding. No black pudding, that's a no-no.
I know.
But where's the beer in that? Where's the beer in that recipe anyway? I mean, it's a lusty soul who has beer before at the breakfast time.
Yeah, where is the beer? Okay. Tell us where the beer is.
I think it's that one. It was some of the things we do. It's just a pairing, like would just be really, really great with this dish.
A Fuller's London Pride,
and you can always throw beer into any of that stuff. Cooking your beans, whatever, and you can just throw it right in there or cook your sausage and beer. There are lots of ways. There are a lot of... Oh, actually, that's true. I forgot about that.
The
sausage does have beer in it.
That's a great beer anyway. Fuller's London Pride is a great beer.
It is.
Even though I save myself and I claim it for my native land, it's still true.
Yeah, no, I think we should mention that you also have an appendix which talks about special beers to give even more information so that people can move on and design their own recipes.
Yeah, I think one thing we were trying to do is, we wanted to give the information about the beers that we had chosen. But we definitely were aware of the fact that not every market is going to have every beer that we wanted to put in the book. So giving that extra information about those beers hopefully will allow people to understand the beer that we picked and then be able to go to a store and say, hey, I'm looking for something like this, or it has these flavors, or that way, if they wanted to do that same dish, they could easily do it and just find something really similar, and it would still work.
Well, that's great. Listen, we're gonna have to say goodbye, because I got to go do some prepping to cook with beer.
Oh, lucky you!
Oh yeah, you use beer in your.
Of course I do.
Chicken.
It's beer canned chicken, and I don't have any rosemary, which I usually put in there. So I'm gonna have to figure out what to do instead.
Well, ask Brooke.
So what kind of beer are you gonna use tonight?
Probably black and tan.
That'd be fun. Yeah,
that's what I usually use.
Yeah. But would that go good with would that fit with sage?
Oh, yeah. That'll be really tasty.
Oh, good. Okay.
Sage.
Great,
yeah. Sage and thyme, maybe?
Yeah, sage, thyme. Put some.
I cut the rosemary bushes down the other day to make a different dish, so I don't have any of that, which is why I'm so.
Oh, no.
Yeah. So I better go do that, and I'll bet you have to get ready for a crowd coming in tonight anyway. So.
Oh, yeah.
Thank you so much for taking the time to talk to us.
And we look forward to actually coming there and meeting you.
Yeah, we'll come and see you sometime.
We look forward to it as well. Thank you very much.
Well, I knew that there was a revival of cider, but I didn't realize we were having a revival also of mead. But guest Steve Piatz is an expert on it. Now, you started, Steve, as it must have been a hobby, because your career was really in engineering, and particularly software engineering. And I guess it just developed from a hobby or just an interest?
Just an interest, hobby. Made my living doing computers.
Yeah, but you really have a lot of credentials for what you're doing with mead.
I guess, yeah. I've won more than a few medals in home mead competitions.
Well, this book called The Complete Guide to Making Mead, you wrote it more as like almost a technical manual on how to make mead, enter contests, and win prizes, huh?
Pretty much, yeah. It's focused on the home mead maker rather than a commercial setting, obviously.
There are commercial meaderies?
Yes, there are. They're getting to be a fair number of them. Most of them are relatively small, at least so far.
Peter's brother and his family have lived in St. Agnes, Cornwall for years, and we've been going there for years. And I thought it was most unusual that they had an actual, and still have, an actual meadery there. And you drink mead, of course, and you eat everything with your fingers.
Well, it's mostly a restaurant.
Uh-huh.
I'm not sure if they make mead. They just call it a meadery, which is a winery is a place where they make wine. A meadery is a place where they make mead. But give us a little bit of history, because I'll bet that there's a significant percentage of our audience who don't even know what mead is.
All right. We can start with what mead is. And this definition is relatively simple, I guess. It's a alcoholic beverage that the majority of the fermentable sugars in the beverage came from honey. In the case of grape wine, obviously the sugars come from the grapes, and in beer, it comes from the barley. So honey is the primary source of fermentables and meads, but it can have other things added to it. It can have spices, it can have grapes, apples, other fruits. So there's a pretty broad spectrum of things going into it. Historically, really isn't much written that tells us what mead tasted like long ago. One of the earliest references is probably Beowulf, which I think is, you know, they believe was written in the 8th or the 11th century, something like that, by some anonymous guy who will never get credit for his work, but he mentions mead halls and, you know, drinking mead and basically all the legends of yore. But in reality, mead goes back way farther. Mead is probably the oldest alcoholic beverage that humans know, because honey was really the first nearly pure sugar source that man would have found in the early days. We didn't raise barley yet. We probably didn't raise grapes yet. But we probably, our early ancestors, stumbled across a beehive or two, found that was pretty nice stuff, even though they got stung like crazy, I'm guessing.
Yeah, I was wondering about how they figured out how to get to extract the honey without being stung.
Yeah, that probably took a couple of years of, you know, trial and error. You know, nowadays bees, beekeepers have it pretty well down. A little smoke keeps the bees away. But somewhere along the way, somebody probably ate most of the honey through the leftover hive and whatever, you know, parts into some water or something in a pot or a leather pouch that was probably all they had at that time to hold liquid, and left it sit for a few days, and surprise, surprise, there was alcohol in there. They didn't know what it was, but it sure had a nice after effect when they drank it. And over time, you know, some people would claim that grapes were cultivated as an inferior substitute for making mead, and that, you know, beer was, you know, yet a further removed thing from mead. It's hard to know if that's really true because we don't have good written data from those days.
Now, what parts of the world is mead traditional? I associate it, as I mentioned before we came on the air, for some reason with King Arthur and the Knights of the Round Table all sitting around chatting about this, that, and the other, and quaffing mead, because in part of the world where they lived, there certainly wasn't any wine. But
yeah,
where does the tradition come from?
Well, I think a lot of that would come from Beowulf, which is an old English poem, long, kind of hard to follow by today's
standards.
I
had to read that in college, you know that.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
In engineering school, we didn't have to read that.
Well, I was in literature, and we did. In Middle English.
Yeah, I think our son read it, too.
And I would guess that mead goes back to the Middle East, because that's where most civilizations started. There seems to be a long history of a mead-like beverage in Ethiopia called tej. I don't know how far back that one goes either, but it's a spontaneously fermented honey beverage, which would make it a mead by the simple definition. So it's a very old beverage. It's speculated that the Egyptians knew what mead was, as well as beer and grape wine. Probably the Greeks.
The Romans loved honey wine.
Right. Yeah, that was one of their favorite things, was to make what we would call a piment today, which is basically a mead where one of the fermentable sources is going to be grape. And one way to do that, of course, you can do it after fermentation. You could ferment the mead and ferment the wine and mix them later.
But it's sort of hung on as a sort of an out-of-the-way beverage for all this time then?
Yeah, it became very scarce. I mean, I can think of, you know, I think Chaucer's Meadery in the UK is one of the older ones that comes to mind that I ever stumbled across years ago that's still in business. There really weren't many commercial sources around the world.
Now, you attributed the decline of mead to a decline of honey bees, or bees making honey, right?
Correct. Some of the stuff I've read would indicate that there were many causes for that probably over time, but for early humans, there were a lot more bees per capita of people than there are today, and there were a lot more wildflowers. There were, you know, if you think about just letting Mother Nature take over huge swaths of land and having wildflowers and things, the bees would do quite well. There would be lots of honey. One source felt that part of the decline in mead and in honey was simply the Reformation in the Catholic Church.
Oh, that was the one. That was
what? Well, what happened then is...
Tell us about that. That is hysterical. I love that.
Well, the claim was that because the churches prior to Reformation were doing so many high masses in the Catholic Church, and high masses had lots of candles.
And beeswax candles,
so they needed lots of colonies of bees to collect enough wax to make the candles, which just happened to have some leftover honey that they could find other uses for. When the Reformation happened and they weren't doing nearly as many high masses, then there wasn't near as much need for beeswax.
Uh-huh. That
the claim was some of the big cathedrals might use 30,000 pounds of beeswax a year.
That was impressive. I really had never even thought of that.
Kind of one of those weird side effects.
Well, do you think this renewed interest in mead is because we're all so fascinated with bees today? Now we're having in-city rooftops devoted to apiaries, and I don't know, it seems a really cool thing to keep bees in the city now.
Yeah, it really is around here, I know, but I think the rise of mead started 10-plus years ago, even before bees were hitting the news so much.
Yeah, so what
One of the books that caused the homebrew interest was Ken Schramm's The Complete Mead Maker in 2003 or 2004, where he it was one of the first books that really described what was going on, and he's a prolific home brewer mead maker, though now he's a commercial mead maker, that started more interest amongst a lot of people in the home brewing world who had dabbled with mead but really didn't have good advice on how to make it.
So you decided it was time for people to get just the right way of doing it.
Correct.
You woke up one morning and said, I'm just going to write this book because I've had
it. Well, actually, I was approached
time.
By the publisher to, would I be interested in writing it? So it was the other way around.
Oh, I see. So they thought there might be a demand for a book and they found someone who could write it.
Correct.
Well, there's so many components to mead that I never knew existed, starting with variations in the honey.
Yes, isn't that amazing? Honey, we think of honey as just honey. And most people, I would guess, around the world, the dominant honey is something like clover honey because there's just so much of it.
Yeah.
It's your standard grocery store honey, but there's so many other flavors and colors.
And then, of course, as with everything fermented, the bacterial strain is important. And,
yes.
And I didn't realize how important total sterilization of all your equipment for making the mead. How important it is.
You can get away with a lot of carelessness in wine and making in comparison to beer making, surprisingly.
Really?
I mean, it's still important to be sanitary. I think it's impossible to be sterile unless you're working in an autoclave in a, major hospital. But paying attention to sanitation just helps you avoid some of the minor little off flavors and things that you might not really want. And people have got so good at it, and the sanitizers that are available are so much better now than they were a few years ago when people were just using basically chlorine bleach and water.
That's not so good.
now help our listeners to get an idea before they get too excited, or maybe to get them more excited. How straightforward is it? Let's assume that people have your book. How successful are they going to be in making a product they're going to enjoy?
It's pretty easy. I mean, obviously, there's difference in personal tastes for dry versus super sweet and everywhere in between. But the process for making what we call a traditional mead, which just has honey, water, yeast, and nutrient in it, is really quite simple. If you pay attention to sanitation and follow the step-by-step procedures in the book, it should turn out pretty darn drinkable. Old school world of, how you made mead was a lot more complicated and a lot more iffy.
Really? Like what?
Well, first off, the old recipes, people would boil everything. In my book, there's no boiling. And the other thing is they would usually add a bunch of acids to just final flavor the balance of the mead. But they'd add them right at the beginning. But that tended to screw up the pH, if you will, of the fermentation so badly that the yeast were hard-pressed to ferment the sugar in a timely way and without producing all kinds of off flavors.
Uh-huh.
And then as a result, the mead might take years until it was drinkable.
So, but you do recommend aging.
You can age, and many meads will be ready to drink in several months, but they may get better over time, and they may not. It's hard to predict up front how long they're going to last in terms of when they're going to peak. It's kind of like with wine. We've learned over time that certain red wines are going to age well versus others. And with meads, there isn't as big of knowledge base as to what varieties and what ingredients make a more ageable mead that's got, maybe will hit its prime at 10 years out or whatever and be good for another 10 after that.
Now, what about mead with food? I mean, is mead for quaffing or is mead for drinking with a meal? What do you think?
It kind of depends on what kind of mead you're making. So you could make a 6-8% alcohol mead, which would be just a little stronger than your so-called everyday beer. And so that you could actually quaff with a meal. If you make it as strong as a wine, say 12-14%, somewhere in that range, then it's more like a wine. You can have a glass with the meal, and you could even make a really sweet one, and then it would be more like a dessert wine.
And you could make it bubbly, too.
Yes.
Yeah, that surprised me.
Yeah, so you could make it at any sweetness level and carbonate it and have it, be really fizzy or just slightly fizzy. All those options are available. That's what's so amazing.
Well, anyhow, your book walks everybody through the equipment needed, the ingredients, how the processes work, and has a whole section on recipes. You sort of are a little bit vague about how accurate the measurements have to be, but you do have recipes. So you're
The vagueness is that the way I make my mead is I have a target original gravity on the hydrometer, which tells you how much sugar is in the solution. I'll dump the honey into my fermenter and then add water, stirring until I get it to that original gravity, rather than going the other way around and saying, well, okay, I'm going to make a batch and I'm going to use 18.37 pounds of honey because that's what the recipe says. I go with the amount of honey I have that I can get out of the jug or whatever, and then adjust the water as necessary because that's an easier thing to do. What you find is honey is really messy to measure and sometimes really, really hard to measure. You may be dealing with honey that's a little crystallized and chunky.
And then I like you talking about the early mead makers not having the sophisticated equipment and whatnot, ended up eating a lot of dead bees. That was so attractive.
Yeah, that's one of the other interesting things alluded to in some of the literature, that modern meads are kind of, I guess, you know, dull in comparison, but, you know, since there are no real taste descriptions of those meads in Beowulf, I don't know if that's true or not, but, you know, some of the authors have said, well, that's in part because the practice has changed. It used to be when you harvested honey from a beehive, you took the combs and the whole works and, you know, basically crushed those to get the honey out, mm-hmm. and you never reused those combs in the hive. Right. Today's practice on honey production, as I understand it, is you would take and slice the top off all the comb, so that you could extract the honey and get that all out, and then you would put the combs back into the hive so the bees could reuse them. Uh-huh. So in the old days, the honey that you used to make mead, you would have thrown the comb, which probably had some dead bees, it would have had the wax, the propolis, all the other parts of the hive would have went in to become part of your mead, and obviously a lot of it would just floated on the top, you hope. But there could have been trace micronutrients or who knows what in the process. In the old practice.
It's a protein, I guess.
Yeah, there was definitely protein.
Well, listen, Steve Piatz, the book is called The Complete Guide to Making Mead, and I think that listeners, if you want to just start this venture, this is the book to go to, because you even have troubleshooting. You have everything anybody needs to know about mead making.
And you can have a whole new hobby.
And it's a hobby that, you know, you'll find lots of your friends are interested in.
Well, Steve, thank you so much for bringing us the story of mead all the way from Minnesota. And we wish you continued success with the development of your science, I guess you'd call it. And hope you get lots more fans as a result of this broadcast.
All right. Thank you.
Well, we seem to have been chatting a lot today, dear. I don't know how we managed to get this far into the program, but we certainly hope you found it interesting and that it will make your drinking all the more satisfying, knowing all these wonderful details that you didn't know before.
Right.
And until next week, same time, same place.
Bye-bye.